John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. Oldest story in America, right? Strike oil in your backyard and suddenly you're rich beyond your wildest dreams, right? Not so fast, modern-day Jethros and grannies. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And just as the United States is poised to become the largest producer of energy in the world, New York State may have erected the biggest barrier to energy development in history. According to a court ruling yesterday, states can allow cities and localities to ban development of oil and gas, including the controversial practice of fracking for natural gas on private lands. We're going to take a look at that this hour. We're also going to look at how young people are remaking the Middle East. We'll look at the history of how now may be much more important than the days when the old Middle East maps were being made. It's the young nations of the Arab world, the young people of the Arab world who are remaking history. And we have the nation of Belgium to kick around on this day in honor of the U.S. versus Belgium in the World Cup. Plus, who had to eat some hallucinogenic cactus to get us to the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision? I kid you not. It's real history, and we'll talk about it later this hour. But first, on Monday, New York's highest court ruled that towns can use zoning ordinances to instate bans on fracking. The ridges of the Marcellus Shale are those in question. The rock formation, which stretches all throughout the Appalachians, harbors an estimated 80 trillion cubic feet of undiscovered natural gas. And atop that rock are two towns, Dryden and Middlefield, both of which are at the center of Monday's suit. An estimated 180 towns in the state of New York have already adopted local measures to curb and control fracking in their communities. The industry went to court to stop them. They lost. It's expected that the ruling will likely encourage other towns, both in New York and around the country, to either implement new regulations or uphold existing bans. We spoke to Zahra Hirji, a reporter covering fracking across the country for Inside Climate News, and Deborah Goldberg, managing attorney at Earth Justice, and the lawyer representing the town of Dryden, New York, a defendant in the case. Goldberg says this victory is a big deal for Dryden.
Well, it means that all their efforts to educate themselves, organize, petition their local representatives, and work together with those officials have worked, and they have actually succeeded in defeating an attack on their community by a very rich, powerful, and arrogant industry.
But if I have, you know, natural gas in my backyard and, you know, my kids need to go to college, why can't I develop that on my own?
Well, you know, you might have all kinds of things that you would want to develop in order to make money. You might want to put in an arsenic plant. But you have to operate consistently with your neighbors, and that's what zoning is all about.
Zahra Hirji is a reporter who covers fracking issues across the country for Inside Climate News. Zahra, does this really constitute a revolutionary obstacle to the development of oil, gas, and mineral rights in places like New York? And, you know, Pennsylvania is a big one coming down the pike here. And, of course, there's all sorts of precedents in the West.
Hi, thank you for having me. I think this is a very big win and will be a rallying point for communities across the nation that are increasingly frustrated with the fast development of fracking that has brought oil and gas drilling in places that it's been around for decades. I mean, you mentioned Colorado or Pennsylvania, but it's brought it a lot closer to communities and into people's backyards. This decision will be a victory for sure, but how it will actually play out in other states that have their own rules is really hard to tell. Every state is going to have their own fights, and I think this is a very big win for New York, but I don't think it's going to decelerate growth in South Texas, for example.
And how would you say the political environments in these various localities affect the regulatory environment of the industry?
Oh, dramatically. I mean, in some places where oil and gas drilling has been around for a while, there's a very strong relationship between the regulators and the industry. there is a push with these full-out bans, but also with temporary moratoriums to kind of slow down the growth, to take a pause and reassess what kind of rules do we already have on the books and what do we need. In many of these places, the reason these communities are pushing for this pause is because there are a lot of questions surrounding what are the environmental or the public health issues. And I think, as we saw in Colorado this past February that pushed a lot of new, stricter rules, the industry recognizes and state legislatures often recognize that there can be a range of rules on the books and that, you know, in Colorado they wanted to put stricter rules. But that decision, again, will really have to be made on every state level.
How much is technology driving this, Deborah Goldberg, in the sense that, you know, with fracking, you can drill sideways and, you know, every which way once you disrupt the rock underneath the soil and start that gas bubbling?
Well, the technology is huge because what those long lateral wells mean is that the fracking fluids that are needed to develop the gas are much, much more voluminous than they used to be in the past. An ordinary conventional well uses about 80,000 gallons of water and chemicals and sand. A fracked well uses as much as 8 million gallons. And of course, what that means is both that the potential for spills is much greater, but also that the wastes that come back to the surface are massive. And the truck trips that go through these communities to deliver both the water and the chemicals are at a scale that these communities have never seen before. And it's this whole industrialization of the communities that's really driving the resistance.
Now, the price of gas is driving the industry, and there's also a consistent call, even from the White House, Deborah Goldberg, for energy independence. We want to be able to get our energy from places that are far away from the conflicts in the world. This is exactly the kind of development that would do that. How is that argument presented in court, and what do you say to that argument?
Well, the argument doesn't really affect the decision in the court, which is based strictly on statutory interpretation. But I have to say that that argument is a little bit disingenuous when, at the same time, the administration is pressing for the export of our natural gas resources. There's no way that we are going to maintain energy independence or maintain a low price on gas if what we do is send it overseas to places like India and Japan, which is what is proposed for the Cove Point, Maryland LNG export facility.
And that would be liquefied natural gas that could
come
into play and help in the Ukraine crisis by giving an alternative to Europe for natural gas that was coming from Russia. That's a good thing. That's a stabilizing feature of world politics that the U.S. would have a hand in.
Well, that liquid natural gas is not going to get to the Ukraine in any time that is going to be relevant to the current crisis. It's going to be years before these facilities are developed and years before the gas can be exported. And moreover, it's not proposed to go to Europe. It's proposed to go to Asia.
So, Zara Hirji, how much are these, you know, giant geopolitical issues entangled with some of these local regulations that you're seeing in the fracking discussion around the country?
I think oftentimes at the very local level, it really comes down to this issue is, pardon my pun, but fracturing communities. It's a clear economic benefit. You can quantify how much money is being produced or how many jobs are being produced. But there's still so many questions about what are the environmental and the public health, whether it's the air issues or the water issues, coming out of this industry. And so for some people, it really comes down to wanting to get those questions answered and the money not being worth that unknown.
Is this eventually going to a federal resolution, or will this remain a state-by-state legislative sort of patchwork quilt? And give me a sense with a map in my own brain of what states are pro-fracking and what states are very much like New York.
I think a lot has to play out at the state level before it moves into the federal jurisdiction. We're starting to see, even in the most drilling-heavy, pro-drilling states such as Texas or Colorado, a real push from communities. So Colorado is another very big, relatively pro-fracking state. I mean, the governor just has been very pro-industry and working with industry to get new rules on the books in February, but many communities are trying to push back. Yes, North Dakota is a place that has a lot of fracking and there isn't as much of a community push. But, you know, I think we're starting to see it grow across the nation, even in the very drilling intensive states.
And North Dakota is booming, that's for sure. Deborah Goldberg, some final thoughts?
I think that the local communities should take heart from the Dryden decision. It is possible to stand up for yourselves and fight back and get improvements. Even the improvements that are being made on the regulatory level in the states are a result of enormous pressure from the public to improve the conditions in which they're living when these wells and other infrastructure come into their backyards.
Deborah Goldberg is managing attorney at Earth Justice and the lawyer representing the defendant, the town of Dryden, in the state of New York case against who has authority over fracking in towns and jurisdictions. The state says that towns can ban fracking within their jurisdictions. Zara Hirji is a reporter covering fracking across the country for Inside Climate News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank
you. My pleasure.
Can they do something here? It's Cristiano Ronaldo. Oh, it's a great cross, and it is an equalizer!
It's time, America. They already own our beer, you know. Belgium stands in our way, and today is a day for drinking a Yingling, folks. That's the patriotic spirit. To get to the round of 16, having survived the group of death, having avoided being bitten by Luis Suarez, today in Brazil, the men's U.S. soccer team could be 90 minutes away from what arguably would be their greatest ever result in the tournament, a chance to again play in the quarterfinals, an elite tier already graced by soccer gods Germany, Brazil, France, Costa Rica. Okay, Costa Rica is a bit of a surprise at this point. But all that stands in the way of such glory for the USA is a country that we can sneer at a little bit, Belgium. We can be sure U.S. coach Jurgen Klinsmann knows tons about Germany, but what about Belgium? Probably a lot, because his country has invaded it a couple of times in the 20th century. What should we know? And more importantly, what is there to know about the land of Walloons? Somber for a moment, this small European country has played a big part in world history. The fields of Flanders, where President Obama visited weeks ago, highlighting the extent to which Belgium has played that role. These days, Brussels, yes, they named some sprouts after the city, is the epic center of European politics, home to thousands of European Union bureaucrats and politicians. Why do we care? It's also the civilian headquarters of NATO. Why do we care? So you can also add English to Dutch, Flemish, French, and German as languages that you'll hear most often in Belgium. Belgium has given the world some very fine chocolate and the beer. Oh, the beer.
Avec Chimay, j'ose dire tout ce que je pense.
Chimay, brewed by monks and after just a few bottles, guaranteed to leave you speechless. The Belgian beer industry bought Budweiser in 2010, folks. But if it's food you're after, turns out French fries are not so French. It's widely thought we should really call French fries Belgian fries, according to Belgian journalist Jo Gerard. He says a family manuscript from 1781 recounts that potatoes were deep-fried prior to 1680 in what was then the Spanish Netherlands, present-day Belgium. Other than good food and drink, Belgium has also given us a few characters we love.
How much for the boat?
I'm sorry, I just sold it to this young gent.
Tell me what you paid, and I'll give you double.
Thanks, but it's not for sale.
Look, kid, I'm trying to help you out. I don't think you realize this, but you're about to walk into a whole mess of danger.
What kind of danger?
I'm warning you. These people do not play nice.
American he was, all hair oil and no socks.
Tintin. And a few we might hate.
Eat hearty, my Smurfs.
Won't you join us, Papa Smurf?
No, Smurfette. I need some rare wrinkle root, which only grows on the far side of the mountains. But I shall return in a few Smurfs. Meantime, be sure to finish the repairs on the dam.
You can count on us, Papa Smurf.
Belgium came up with the Smurfs? That's enough to disqualify them from the World Cup. But we'll redeem Belgium with this. It's a musical piece which brings us full circle and back to today's match. Composer Henri Vautrin was born in Verviers. It was in the Netherlands back in 1820, but it's Belgium now. Vautrin made his fame in Paris and wrote a piece called Souvenir d'Amérique, Variations Burlesque sur Yankee Doodle, published 1843. Hey, folks, this could be a close one. It's almost like Belgium is already rooting for us. Go USA, go Belgium, go Yankees. Talked a lot about the old maps in the Middle East and North Africa, some of those maps with borders drawn a century ago. We've talked about how the current conflicts reflect old history haunting today's headlines. But we should remember that there are other dynamics and factors that are driving the situation, and they are demographic. In the 3 years since the Arab Spring began, for instance, Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya have all taken a peek, at varying degrees, when it comes to democracy and human rights. But our next guest says it is the youth of the protesters who led the Arab Spring that may matter most. Even looking at today's headlines about possible Israeli retaliation for the deaths of three teenagers by attacking Palestinian Arabs in Gaza, this is a war of young people versus young people as much as anything. Joining us is Juan Cole, author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. He's director of the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan. Welcome to The Takeaway, Professor.
Thank you so much, John.
So how young are we talking here, and how much is the young spirit of these millennials really driving the revolutions in various countries?
Oh, they're absolutely central. The generation born roughly from the late 70s into the year 2000 are called by demographers the millennials or Generation Y. And they're, of course, a global phenomenon, but in the Arab world, they're particularly populous, maybe something like 40% of the population.
Wow.
So it's an enormous bulge of people. And what's interesting about them is not just that they're there and they're young, because that's also true of youth in India and Indonesia, a lot of places in the world. But that they're organized on the basis of being young. That is to say, they have formed a political and social cultural organizations which have the word youth in them and which strive to represent their generation.
How do they interpret Islam? How do they interpret notions like jihad? You're talking about people who have probably no memory of the revolution in Iran, which involved Persians, not Arabs, but was very, very influential in the Arab world. You know, people like Nasser and Sadat are, you know, probably virtually unknown to this generation.
Well, they've gone to school, so they do have a historical memory in that way of people like Gamal Abdel Nasser, the great Egyptian nationalist leader. But yes, I mean, you're getting at something, which is that the divisions of their parents' generation were really about a kind of military nationalism versus political Islam. That was the great divide. And of course, that generation, the baby boomers, people who are now in their 60s, are still duking it out over those issues. But the social science on the younger generation, on the millennials in the Arab world, suggests that they are much more interested in networking and a kind of more democratic view of how society should work. And it finds that they're universally at least somewhat less religious observant, religiously observant than their parents.
How do we think that reflects politically? Are these likely to join the parties of their parents? Are these people likely to vote in traditional institutions or take matters into their own hands, as was the case for part of the time in the Arab Spring in Egypt, where really the election was with people's feet on the streets of Tahrir Square or in social media?
Well, the activists among them tend not to be very interested in traditional political parties. And in many ways, the dictators of the region, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, who ruled 1981 till 2011, and others in Tunisia and elsewhere, destroyed a lot of the old political parties. And so the youth tend to be fairly alienated from parties and not very interested in them on the whole.
Would you say that there's an export market for people who would want to attack the West from radicalism within young parties that are developing now, that this dissatisfaction leads to a kind of political expression outside the borders of their own countries? Or are these people who want to remain home, remain leaders, become part of a new political generation?
Well, they would very much like. The activists that I'm talking about tend to be left of center or liberal. Some of them are interested in political Islam, but not of the hardline sort. So these people really want to see their own societies shaped in a different direction, and that's where they've put their energies. On the other hand, to the extent that politics is very difficult in a place like, say, Egypt, a very large numbers of young people report that if they could emigrate to the West, they would, but not as a critique of the West, as a search for a better life.
What about the state of Israel? Will it remain as central an issue as it has for two generations now?
Well, these young people obviously have sympathies with the Palestinians and how they view them to be treated by the Israelis. But on the whole and by and large, at least in the past 3 years, they haven't made Israel the issue. And I think there's a feeling amongst them that the old dictatorial regimes tended to use the issue of Israel and American foreign policy as ways of deflecting critiques of how the country was actually run, domestic policy. And so when I was in Tahrir Square, when there were huge demonstrations in the summer of 2011, a few months after the revolution, I didn't see a single placard about Israel or the United States. It was all about wanting the dictator Hosni Mubarak to be tried. And so, I mean, they have feelings on that issue. I think they're determined not to let it derail their project of changing the way their societies run.
And do you think they'll succeed?
Well, this is something that I think is really important to underline. I think people don't realize how young these guys were, the young women and young men who made these revolutions. They were 20-somethings, 21, 22, at most, 32. That was some of the older mm-hmm. activists. And so people asked me, why didn't they run for office? Well, they're not eligible to run for office. They're not old enough in many cases. And so it's way too soon to tell how the changes that they kicked off starting in 2011 are going to work out.
Juan Cole is the author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, and he's director of the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome, John.
We're going to end this hour by revisiting a story we told you about yesterday, the Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court. It's a 5-4 decision about religious freedom that stems from a very strange bit of history that motivated Congress to pass a law that was the basis of this lawsuit. The court ruled in favor of two Christian-owned companies, you'll remember, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties, that challenged Obamacare provisions requiring the companies, privately held companies, to provide contraceptive benefits for their employees, saying that they violated the Christian religious practices of the company's owners. Now, there are already discussions in Congress of giving those employees exemptions so that the company owners don't have to actually pay for the contraceptive provisions. But this case stemmed from the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, RFRA it's called. The law at issue there in the decision came to pass in 1993. RFRA was adopted to counteract a 1990 Supreme Court case called Oregon versus Smith. The majority decision was written by Judge Scalia, in which two Native American men were denied unemployment benefits because they were fired for smoking hallucinogenic peyote cactus as part of what they said was their own religious ritual. Carolyn Long is the author of Religious Freedom and Indian Rights, The Case of Oregon v. Smith. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is some fascinating history. If you know anything about the West, you know all about peyote culture and mushroom culture and the hallucinogenic sort of tribes and rituals that existed out there. This one made its way to the Supreme Court and really caused Congress to say, hey, wait a minute, we need a law to protect religion. Can you sketch out the history for us?
Sure. You know, the Smith case started out as a small religious liberty case involving a Native American practicing his religious rights. And then the Supreme Court used the opportunity when it decided the case to turn it into a landmark First Amendment free exercise decision. The case involved Al Smith, who was a Klamath Indian, who was a treatment counselor for a drug and alcohol abuse center. And he used Native American practices in his treatment of drug and alcohol abuse. As a counselor, he would use sweat lodges, drumming ceremonies to help connect with Native American community members who were struggling. And that part of his work was his practice of his own religion. He was a member of the Native American church where they ingest peyote as sacrament. At the time, it was illegal in the state of Oregon. So when Smith told his employers about this religious practice, he was fired from his job and subsequently denied unemployment compensation by the state.
Now, when this case went before the Supreme Court, the argument was basically that the federal government is not to restrict the exercise, the free exercise of any religion. But Scalia took a different tack. He said, no. It's different that if you want to explicitly permit the free exercise of some exotic religious ritual, you're going to have to legislatively pass a law that says that eating peyote in this case is okay. Am I fairly characterizing what happened in 1993 or not in 1993 during the case in 1990?
You are. Well, what happened was prior to the Smith decision, for over 30 years, the court had used a certain balancing test in order to evaluate religious claims, regardless of whether or not the government action infringing on one's religion was a direct government action or an indirect government action. So what Scalia said in the Smith decision was that the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause only protects individuals when government directly infringes on someone's religious freedom. If somebody is impacted from exercising their religion from what he called a neutral, generally applicable law, they were not protected by the First Amendment, and they had to seek protection through the legislative process.
All right, so let me back up here. So Scalia was saying that the fact that peyote was illegal was a generally applicable law, and for the Indians to get the right to use it in a religious ritual, they had to get a special ordinance passed that gave them a waiver from the illegality of the peyote. Am I right there?
That's correct. And that actually was the case for about half of the states in the union. But Oregon had not passed that exemption to its state law.
So all of a sudden, the Christian evangelists and other conservatives and, you know, who knows, maybe well-meaning Unitarians and all kinds of Christians and Muslims and Jews said, whoa, Scalia here is basically making it more difficult potentially for me to practice my religion, and thereby came the momentum for this RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Explain that.
Well, that's absolutely the case. The controversy went away from Smith, and he has his own compelling, you know, personal story, and about how the Smith decision essentially lowered the bar of protection for the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause for everybody. So it was a stunning decision, and individuals in the religious and civil liberties communities who were took by surprise with this decision decided that they had to do something in order to address it. And so what they did is they sought out a legislative solution to try to circumvent the Smith decision, and that was essentially the Coalition for the Free Exercise of Religion, which helped shepherd the RFRA case through Congress.
And so now what is the test under RFRA, which was before the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case?
So the test for RFRA was the one that existed prior to the Smith decision for about 30 years. The test is a three-part test. If somebody first shows that the a government action places a substantial burden on their religion, then that government action must be shown to achieve a compelling government interest achieved in the least restrictive manner possible. So it's a very high threshold. It's the high threshold that existed prior to Smith. And so what RFRA did is it essentially brought back this statutory balancing test that had existed under constitutional law prior to the Smith decision.
And do you think the requirement of the Hobby Lobby owners to pay for the Obamacare provisions that offered contraceptions is a high burden? It passes that RFRA test?
I think that...
I know I'm putting you on the spot here.
No, that's fine. I think that personally, I think it's a difficult argument to make. But what the court usually does is they accept the religious adherence argument about it being a burden. Because what may be a burden to one person may not be a burden to another. One could say that the burden is very far attenuated from the actual individual's religion, which is the case in Hobby Lobby in the Constantega case. But the court essentially agreed that it was a burden.
Wouldn't you love to have like a party, though, with the Conestoga people and the Hobby Lobby people and the Indians, you know, just sitting in the sweat lodge eating peyote, just talking about, isn't it ironic, this country we live in, America?
It would be totally ironic. One of the ironies is that one of the reasons why it took RFRA so long to be passed into law was that pro-life groups opposed RFRA because they believed that it would actually create a constitutional right to abortion. And so it stalled the legislation for over 3 years, that issue. And so to find out that now RFRA is being used in order to provide statutory protection for for-profit businesses to deny contraceptive services to individuals is sort of a fascinating twist.
Well, it's, you know, if angry or not at the decision, America is sometimes a very remarkable, magical place, legally speaking. Carolyn Long, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carolyn Long is the author of Religious Freedom and Indian Rights, The Case of Oregon versus Smith. She's a professor at the School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs at Washington State University, Vancouver. We want to welcome our new listeners to The Takeaway in Atlanta, Georgia, joining us for the first time at 88.5 FM. We'd love you to check out our website, follow us on Twitter, be a part of our daily conversation. First Atlanta listener to call us wins a Lexus, a brand. No, that's wrong. I'm lying there. We'll do our best to represent and reflect what matters to you. Of course, the very best of luck to Team USA in Brazil. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.